communists. Every activity must derive its justification from a conscious social purpose. There must be no spontaneous, unguided activity, because it might produce results which cannot be foreseen and for which the plan does not provide. It might produce something new, undreamed of in the philosophy of the planner. The principle extends even to games and amusements. I leave it to the reader to guess whether it was in Germany or in Russia that chess players were officially exhorted that we must finish once and for all with the neutrality of chess. We must condemn once and for all the formula chess for the sake of chess, like the formula art for art's sake. Incredible as some of these aberrations may appear, we must yet be on our guard not to dismiss them as mere accidental byproducts, which have nothing to do with the essential character of a planned or totalitarian system. They are not. They are a direct result of that same desire to see everything directed by a unitary conception of the whole, of the need to uphold at all costs the views in the service of which people are asked to make constant sacrifices, and of the general idea that the knowledge and beliefs of the people are an instrument to be used for a single purpose. Once science has to serve not truth, but the interests of a class, a community, or a state, the sole task of argument and discussion is to vindicate and to spread still further the beliefs by which the whole life of the community is directed. As the Nazi Minister of Justice has explained, the question which every new scientific theory must ask itself is, do I serve national socialism for the greatest benefit of all? The word truth itself ceases to have its old meaning. It describes no longer something to be found, with the individual conscience as the sole arbiter of whether in any particular instance the evidence, or the standing of those proclaiming it, warrants a belief. It becomes something to be laid down by authority, something which has to be believed in the interest of the unity of the organized effort, and which may have to be altered as the exigencies of this organized effort require it. The general intellectual climate which this produces, the spirit of complete cynicism as regards truth which it engenders, the loss of the sense of even the meaning of truth, the disappearance of the spirit of independent inquiry, and of the belief in the power of rational conviction, the way in which differences of opinion in every branch of knowledge become political issues to be decided by authority, are all things which one must personally experience. No short description can convey their extent. Perhaps the most alarming fact is that contempt for intellectual liberty is not a thing which arises only once the totalitarian system is established, but one which can be found everywhere among intellectuals who have embraced a collectivist faith, and who are acclaimed as intellectual leaders, even in countries still under a liberal regime. Not only is even the worst oppression condoned if it is committed in the name of socialism, and the creation of a totalitarian system openly advocated by people who pretend to speak for the scientists of liberal countries, intolerance, too, is openly extolled. Have we not recently seen a British scientific writer defend even inquisition because, in his opinion, it is beneficial to science when it protects a rising class? J.G. Crowther, The Social Relations of Science, 1941, page 333. This view is, of course, practically indistinguishable from the views which led the Nazis to the persecution of men of science, the burning of scientific books, and the systematic eradication of the intelligentsia of the subjected people. The desire to force upon the people a creed which is regarded as salutary for them is, of course, not a thing that is new or peculiar to our time. New, however, is the argument by which many of our intellectuals try to justify such attempts. There is no real freedom of thought in our society, so it is said, because the opinions and tastes of the masses are shaped by propaganda, by advertising, by the example of the upper classes, and by other environmental factors which inevitably force the thinking of the people into well-worn grooves. From this, it is concluded that if the ideals and tastes of the great majority are always fashioned by circumstances which we can control, we ought to use this power deliberately, to turn the thoughts of the people in what we think is a desirable direction. Probably it is true enough that the great majority are rarely capable of thinking independently, that on most questions they accept views which they find ready-made, and that they will be equally content if born or coaxed into one set of beliefs or another. In any society, freedom of thought will probably be of direct significance only for a small minority. But this does not mean that anyone is competent or ought to have power to select those to whom this freedom is to be reserved. It certainly does not justify the presumption of any group of people to claim the right to determine what people ought to think or believe. It shows a complete confusion of thought to suggest that, because under any sort of system, the majority of people follow the lead of somebody, it makes no difference if everybody has to follow the same lead. To deprecate the value of intellectual freedom because it will never mean for everybody the same possibility of independent thought is completely to miss the reasons which give intellectual freedom its value. What is essential to make it serve its function as the prime mover of intellectual progress is not that everybody may be able to think or write anything, but that any cause or idea may be argued by somebody. So long as dissent is not suppressed, there will always be some who will query the ideas ruling their contemporaries and put new ideas to the test of argument and propaganda. This interaction of individuals, possessing different knowledge and different views, is what constitutes the life of thought. The growth of reason is a social process based on the existence of such differences. It is of its essence that its results cannot be predicted, that we cannot know which views will assist this growth and which will not. In short, that this growth cannot be governed by any views which we now possess without at the same time limiting it. To plan or organize the growth of mind, or for that matter, progress in general, is a contradiction in terms. The idea that the human mind ought consciously to control its own development confuses individual reason, which alone can consciously control anything, with the interpersonal process to which its growth is due. By attempting to control it, we are merely setting bounds to its development, and must, sooner or later, produce a stagnation of thought and a decline of reason. The tragedy of collectivist thought is that, while it starts out to make reason supreme, it ends by destroying reason, because it misconceives the process on which the growth of reason depends. It may indeed be said that it is the paradox of all collectivist doctrine, and its demand for conscious control or conscious planning, that they necessarily lead to the demand that the mind of some individual should rule supreme, while only the individualist approach to social phenomena makes us recognize the super-individual forces which guide the growth of reason. Individualism is thus an attitude of humility before this social process, and of tolerance to other opinions, and is the exact opposite of that intellectual hubris which is at the root of the demand for comprehensive direction of the social process. Chapter 12. The Socialist Roots of Nazism. All anti-liberal forces are combining against everything that is liberal. A. Möller-Vandenbroek. It is a common mistake to regard National Socialism as a mere revolt against reason, an irrational movement without intellectual background. If that were so, the movement would be much less dangerous than it is. But nothing could be further from the truth or more misleading. The doctrines of National Socialism are the culmination of a long evolution of thought, a process in which thinkers who have had great influence far beyond the confines of Germany have taken part. Whatever one may think of the premises from which they started, it cannot be denied that the men who produced the new doctrines were powerful writers, who left the impress of their ideas on the whole of European thought. Their system was developed with ruthless consistency. Once one accepts the premises from which it starts, there is no escape from its logic. It is simply collectivism freed from all traces of an individualist tradition which might hamper its realization. Though in this development German thinkers have taken the lead, they were by no means alone. Thomas Carlyle and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Auguste Comte and Georges Sorel are as much a part of that continuous development as any Germans. The development of this strand of thought within Germany has been well traced recently by R.D. Butler in his study of The Roots of National Socialism. But although its persistence there through 150 years in almost unchanged and ever-recurring form, which emerges from that study, is rather frightening, it is easy to exaggerate the importance these ideas had in Germany before 1914. They were only one strand of thought among a people then perhaps more varied in its views than any other, and they were on the whole represented by a small minority, and held in as great contempt by the majority of Germans as they were in other countries. What, then, caused these views held by a reactionary minority finally to gain the support of the great majority of Germans, and practically the whole of her youth? It was not merely the defeat, the suffering, and the wave of nationalism which led to their success. Still less was the cause, as so many people wish to believe, a capitalist reaction against the advance of socialism. On the contrary, the support which brought these ideas to power came precisely from the socialist camp. It was certainly not through the bourgeoisie, but rather through the absence of a strong bourgeoisie, that they were helped to power. The doctrines which had guided the ruling elements in Germany for the past generation were opposed not to the socialism in Marxism, but to the liberal elements contained in it, its internationalism and its democracy. And as it became increasingly clear that it was just these elements which formed obstacles to the realization of socialism, the socialists of the left approached more and more to those of the right. It was the union of the anti-capitalist forces of the right and of the left, the fusion of radical and conservative socialism, which drove out from Germany everything that was liberal. The connection between socialism and nationalism in Germany was close from the beginning. It is significant that the most important ancestors of National Socialism, Fichte, Robertus, and LaSalle, are at the same time acknowledged fathers of socialism. While theoretical socialism in its Marxist form was directing the German labor movement, the authoritarian and nationalist element receded for a time into the background, but not for long. And only partially. In 1892, one of the leaders of the Social Democratic Party, August Bebel, was able to tell Bismarck that the Imperial Chancellor can rest assured that German social democracy is a sort of preparatory school for militarism. From 1914 onward, there arose from the ranks of Marxist socialism one teacher after another who led not the conservatives and reactionaries, but the hard-working laborer and idealist youth into the National Socialist fold. It was only thereafter that the tide of nationalist socialism attained major importance and rapidly grew into the Hitlerian doctrine. The war hysteria of 1914, which, just because of the German defeat, was never fully cured, is the beginning of the modern development which produced National Socialism, and it was largely with the assistance of old socialists that it rose during this period. Perhaps the first, and in some ways the most characteristic representative of this development, is the late Professor Werner Sombart, whose notorious Händler und Helden, Merchants and Heroes, appeared in 1915. Sombart had begun as a Marxian socialist, and as late as 1909 could assert with pride that he had devoted the greater part of his life to fighting for the ideas of Karl Marx. He had done as much as any man to spread socialist ideas and anti-capitalist resentment of varying shades throughout Germany. And if German thought became penetrated with Marxian elements in a way that was true of no other country until the Russian Revolution, this was in a large measure due to Sombart. At one time he was regarded as the outstanding representative of the persecuted socialist intelligentsia, unable, because of his radical views, to obtain a university chair. And even after the last war, the influence, inside and outside Germany, of his work as a historian, which remained Marxist in approach after he had ceased to be a Marxist in politics, was most extensive and is particularly noticeable in the works of many of the English and American planners. In his war book, this old socialist welcomed the German War as the inevitable conflict between the commercial civilization of England and the heroic culture of Germany. His contempt for the commercial views of the English people, who had lost all warlike instincts, is unlimited. Nothing is more contemptible in his eyes than the universal striving after the happiness of the individual, and what he describes as the leading maxim of English morals, "Be just that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the land," is, to him, the most infamous maxim which has ever been pronounced by a commercial mind. The German idea of the state, as formulated by Fichte, LaSalle, and Robertus, is that the state is neither founded nor formed by individuals, nor an aggregate of individuals, nor is its purpose to serve any interest of individuals. It is a Volksgemeinschaft in which the individual has no rights but only duties. Claims of the individual are always an outcome of the commercial spirit. The ideas of 1789, liberty, equality, fraternity, are characteristically commercial ideas, which have no other purpose but to secure certain advantages to individuals. Before 1914, all the true German ideals of a heroic life were in deadly danger before the continuous advance of English commercial ideals, English comfort, and English sport. The English people had not only themselves become completely corrupted, every trade unionist being sunk in the morass of comfort, but they had begun to infect all other peoples. Only the war had helped the Germans to remember that they were really a people of warriors, a people among whom all activities, and particularly all economic activities, were subordinated to military ends. Sombart knew that the Germans were held in contempt by other people because they regard war as sacred, but he glories in it. To regard war as inhuman and senseless is a product of commercial views. There is a life higher than the individual life, the life of the people and the life of the state, and it is the purpose of the individual to sacrifice himself for that higher life. War is to Sombart the consummation of the heroic view of life, and the war against England is the war against the opposite ideal, the commercial ideal of individual freedom and of English comfort, which, in his eyes, finds its most contemptible expression in the safety razors found in the English trenches. If Sombart's outburst was at the time too much even for most Germans, another German professor arrived at essentially the same ideas in a more moderate and more scholarly, but for that reason even more effective, form. Professor Johann Plange was as great an authority on Marx as Sombart. His book on Marx und Hegel marks the beginning of the modern Hegel Renaissance among Marxian scholars, and there can be no doubt about the genuinely socialist nature of the convictions with which he started. Among his numerous war publications, the most important is a small but at the time widely discussed book with the significant title 1789 and 1914, The Symbolic Years in the History of the Political Mind. It is devoted to the conflict between the ideas of 1789, the ideal of freedom, and the ideas of 1914, the ideal of organization. Organization is to him, as to all socialists who derive their socialism from a crude application of scientific ideals to the problems of society, the essence of socialism. It was, as he rightly emphasizes, the root of the socialist movement at its inception in early 19th century France. Marx and Marxism have betrayed this basic idea of socialism by their fanatic but utopian adherence to the abstract idea of freedom. Only now was the idea of organization again coming into its own elsewhere, as witnessed by the work of H.G. Wells, by whose Future in America Professor Plange was profoundly influenced, and whom he describes as one of the outstanding figures of modern socialism. But particularly in Germany, where it is best understood and most fully realized, the war between England and Germany is therefore really a conflict between two opposite principles. The economic world war is the third great epoch of spiritual struggle in modern history. It is of equal importance with the Reformation and the bourgeois revolution of liberty. It is the struggle for the victory of the new forces born out of the advanced economic life of the 19th century, socialism and organization. Because in the sphere of ideas, Germany was the most convinced exponent of all socialist dreams, and in the sphere of reality, she was the most powerful architect of the most highly organized economic system. In us is the 20th century. However the war may end, we are the exemplary people. Our ideas will determine the aims of the life of humanity. World history experiences at present the colossal spectacle that with us, a new great ideal of life penetrates to final victory, while at the same time in England, one of the world historical principles finally collapses. The war economy created in Germany in 1914 is the first realization of a socialist society, and its spirit the first active, and not merely demanding, appearance of a socialist spirit. The needs of the war have established the socialist idea in German economic life, and thus the defense of our nation produced for humanity the idea of 1914, the idea of German organization, the people's community, Volksgemeinschaft, of national socialism. Without our really noticing it, the whole of our political life in state and industry has risen to a higher stage. State and economic life form a new unity. The feeling of economic responsibility which characterizes the work of the civil servant pervades all private activity. The new German corporative constitution of economic life, which Professor Plenge admits is not yet ripe or complete, is the highest form of life of the state which has ever been known on earth. At first, Professor Plenge still hoped to reconcile the ideal of liberty and the ideal of organization, although largely through the complete but voluntary submission of the individual to the whole. But these traces of liberal ideas soon disappear from his writings. By 1918, the union between socialism and ruthless power politics had become complete in his mind. Shortly before the end of the war, he exhorted his compatriots in the socialist journal Die Glocke in the following manner. It is high time to recognize the fact that socialism must be power policy, because it is to be organization. Socialism has to win power. It must never blindly destroy power. And the most important and critical question for socialism in the time of war of peoples is necessarily this. What people is preeminently summoned to power, because it is the exemplary leader in the organization of peoples? And he forecast all the ideas which were finally to justify Hitler's new order. Just from the point of view of socialism, which is organization, is not an absolute right of self-determination of the peoples the right of individualistic economic anarchy? Are we willing to grant complete self-determination to the individual in economic life? Consistent socialism can accord to the people a right to incorporation only in accordance with the real distribution of forces historically determined. The ideals which Plenge expressed so clearly were especially popular among, and perhaps even derived from, certain circles of German scientists and engineers who, precisely as is now so loudly demanded by their English and American counterparts, clamored for the centrally planned organization of all aspects of life. Leading among these was the famous chemist Wilhelm Ostwald, one of whose pronouncements on this point has achieved a certain celebrity. He is reported to have stated publicly that Germany wants to organize Europe, which up to now still lacks organization. I will explain to you now Germany's great secret. We, or perhaps the German race, have discovered the significance of organization. While the other nations still live under the regime of individualism, we have already achieved that of organization. Ideas very similar to these were current in the offices of the German raw material dictator, Walter Rathenau, who, although he would have shuddered had he realized the consequences of his totalitarian economics, yet deserves a considerable place in any fuller history of the growth of Nazi ideas. Through his writings, he has probably, more than any other man, determined the economic views of the generation which grew up in Germany during and immediately after the last war. And some of his closest collaborators were later to form the backbone of the staff of Goering's 5-year plan administration. Very similar also was much of the teaching of another former Marxist, Friedrich Naumann, whose Mittel Europa reached probably the greatest circulation of any war book in Germany. A good summary of Naumann's views, as characteristic of the German combination of socialism and imperialism as any we quote in the text, will be found in R. D. Butler, The Roots of National Socialism, 1941, pages 203 to 209. But it was left to an active socialist politician, a member of the left wing of the Social Democratic Party in the Reichstag, to develop these ideas most fully and to spread them far and wide. Paul Lensch had already, in earlier books, described the war as the flight of the English bourgeoisie before the advance of socialism, and explained how different were the socialist ideal of freedom and the English conception. But only in his third and most successful war book, his 3 Years of World Revolution, were his characteristic ideas, under the influence of Plenge, to achieve full development. Paul Lynch, 3 Years of World Revolution, with a preface by J.E.M., London, 1918. The English translation of this work was made available, still during the last war, by some far-seeing person. Lynch bases his argument on an interesting and in many respects accurate historical account of how the adoption of protection by Bismarck had made possible in Germany a development toward that industrial concentration and cartelization which, from his Marxist standpoint, represented a higher state of industrial development. The result of Bismarck's decision of the year 1879 was that Germany took on the role of the revolutionary, that is to say, of a state whose position in relation to the rest of the world is that of a representative of a higher and more advanced economic system. Having realized this, we should perceive that, in the present world revolution, Germany represents the revolutionary and her greatest antagonist, England, the counter-revolutionary side. This fact proves how little the constitution of a country, whether it be liberal and republican or monarchic and autocratic, affects the question whether, from the point of view of historical development, that country is to be regarded as liberal or not. Or, to put it more plainly, our conceptions of liberalism, democracy, and so forth are derived from the ideas of English individualism, according to which a state with a weak government is a liberal state, and every restriction upon the freedom of the individual is conceived as the product of autocracy and militarism. In Germany, the historically appointed representative of this higher form of economic life, the struggle for socialism has been extraordinarily simplified, since all the prerequisite conditions of socialism had already become established there, and hence it was necessarily a vital concern of any socialist party that Germany should triumphantly hold her own against her enemies, and thereby be able to fulfill her historic mission of revolutionizing the world. Hence, the War of the Entente against Germany resembled the attempt of the lower bourgeoisie of the pre-capitalistic age to prevent the decline of their own class. That organization of capital, Lynch continues, which began unconsciously before the war, and which during the war has been continued consciously, will be systematically continued after the war. Not through any desire for any arts of organization, nor yet because socialism has been recognized as a higher principle of social development. The classes who are today the practical pioneers of socialism are, in theory, its avowed opponents, or at any rate, were so up to a short time ago. Socialism is coming, and in fact, has to some extent already arrived, since we can no longer live without it. The only people who still oppose this tendency are the liberals. This class of people, who unconsciously reason from English standards, comprises the whole educated German bourgeoisie. Their political notions of freedom and civic right, of constitutionalism and parliamentarianism, are derived from that individualistic conception of the world, of which English liberalism is a classical embodiment, and which was adopted by the spokesmen of the German bourgeoisie in the 50s, 60s, and 70s of the 19th century. But these standards are old-fashioned and shattered, just as old-fashioned English liberalism has been shattered by this war. What has to be done now is to get rid of these inherited political ideas and to assist the growth of a new conception of state and society. In this sphere, also, socialism must present a conscious and determined opposition to individualism. In this connection, it is an astonishing fact that, in the so-called reactionary Germany, the working classes have won for themselves a much more solid and powerful position in the life of the state than is the case either in England or in France. Lynch follows this up with a consideration which, again, contains much truth and which deserves to be pondered. Since the Social Democrats, by the aid of this universal suffrage, occupied every post which they could obtain in the Reichstag, the state parliament, the municipal councils, the courts for the settlement of trade disputes, the sick funds, and so forth, they penetrated very deeply into the organism of the state. But the price which they had to pay for this was that the state, in its turn, exercised a profound influence upon the working classes. To be sure, as the result of strenuous socialistic labors for 50 years, The state is no longer the same as it was in the year 1867, when universal suffrage first came into operation. But then, social democracy, in its turn, is no longer the same as it was at the time. The state has undergone a process of socialization, and social democracy has undergone a process of nationalization. Plenge and Lenz, in turn, have provided the leading ideas for the immediate masters of National Socialism, particularly Oswald Spengler and Arthur Müller-Vandenbroek, to mention only the two best-known names. The same applies to many others of the intellectual leaders of the generation which has produced Nazism, such as Otmar Spahn, Hans Freyr, Carl Schmitt, and Ernst Jünger. On these, compare the interesting study by Arthur Kollnay, The War Against the West, 1938, which suffers, however, from the defect that, by confining itself to the post-war period when these ideals had already been taken over by the nationalists, it overlooks their socialist creators. Opinions may differ in how far the former, Spengler, can be regarded as a socialist. But that in his tract on Prussianism and Socialism, which appeared in 1920, he merely gave expression to ideas widely held by German socialists will now be evident. A few specimens of his argument will suffice. Old Prussian spirit and socialist conviction, which today hate each other with the hatred of brothers, are one and the same. The representatives of Western civilization in Germany, the German liberals, are the invisible English army which, after the Battle of Jena, Napoleon left behind on German soil. The Spengler, men like Hardenberg and Humboldt and all the other liberal reformers were English. But this English spirit will be turned out by the German Revolution, which began in 1914. The three last nations of the Occident have aimed at three forms of existence, represented by famous watchwords, freedom, equality, community. They appear in the political forms of liberal parliamentarianism, social democracy, and authoritarian socialism. This Spenglerian formula finds its echo in an often quoted statement of Schmitt, the leading Nazi expert on constitutional law, according to which the evolution of government proceeds in three dialectic stages, from the absolute state of the 17th and 18th centuries through the neutral state of the liberal 19th century to the totalitarian state, in which state and society are identical. Carl Schmitt. Der Hörte der Verfassung. Tübingen, 1931, page 79. The German, more correctly, Prussian, instinct is, the power belongs to the whole, everyone is given his place, one commands or obeys. This is, since the 18th century, authoritarian socialism, essentially illiberal and anti-democratic, insofar as English liberalism and French democracy are meant. There are in Germany many hated and ill-reputed contrasts, but liberalism alone is contemptible on German soil. The structure of the English nation is based on the distinction between rich and poor, that of the Prussian on that between command and obedience. The meaning of class distinction is, accordingly, fundamentally different in the two countries. After pointing out the essential difference between the English competitive system and the Prussian system of economic administration, and after showing, consciously following Lenz, how since Bismarck, the deliberate organization of economic activity had progressively assumed more socialist forms, Spengler continues. In Prussia, there existed a real state in the most ambitious meaning of the word. There could be, strictly speaking, no private persons. Everybody who lived within the system that worked with the precision of a clockwork was in some way a link in it. The conduct of public business could therefore not be in the hands of private people, as is supposed by parliamentarianism. It was an Amt, and the responsible politician was a civil servant, a servant of the whole. The Prussian idea requires that everybody should become a state official, that all wages and salaries be fixed by the state. The administration of all property, in particular, becomes a salaried function. The state of the future will be a Beamtenstaat, but the decisive question not only for Germany, but for the world, which must be solved by Germany for the world, is in the future trade to govern the state or the state to govern trade? In the face of this question, Prussianism and socialism are the same. Prussianism and socialism combat the England in our midst. It was only a step from this for the patron saint of National Socialism, Müller Vandenbroek, to proclaim World War I a war between liberalism and socialism. We have lost the war against the West. Socialism has lost it against liberalism. Arthur Müller Vandenbroek, Sozialismus und Außenpolitik, 1933, pages 87, 90, and 100. The articles here reprinted, particularly the article on Lenin and Keynes, which discusses most fully the contention discussed in the text, were first published between 1919 and 1923. As with Spengler, liberalism is, therefore, the archenemy. Müller Vandenbroek glories in the fact that there are no liberals in Germany today. There are young revolutionaries. There are young conservatives. But who would be a liberal? Liberalism is a philosophy of life from which German youth now turns with nausea, with wrath, with quite peculiar scorn. For there is none more foreign, more repugnant, more opposed to its philosophy. German youth today recognizes the liberal as the archenemy. Müller Vandenbroek's Third Reich was intended to give the Germans a socialism adapted to their nature and undefiled by Western liberal ideas. And so it did. These writers were by no means isolated phenomena. As early as 1922, a detached observer could speak of a peculiar and, on a first glance, surprising phenomenon then to be observed in Germany. The fight against the capitalistic order, according to this view, is a continuation of the war against the Entente, with the weapons of the spirit and of economic organization, the way which leads to practical socialism, a return of the German people to their best and noblest traditions. K. Pribram, Deutscher Nationalismus und Deutscher Sozialismus, Archiv für Sozialwissenschaft und Sozialpolitik, Volume 49, 1922, pages 298 and 299. The writer mentions as further examples the philosopher Max Scheler, preaching the socialist world mission of Germany, and the Marxist K. Korsch, writing on the spirit of the new Volksgemeinschaft, as arguing in the same vein. Fight against liberalism in all its forms, liberalism that had defeated Germany, was the common idea which united socialists and conservatives in one common front. At first, it was mainly in the German youth movement, almost entirely socialist in inspiration and outlook, where these ideas were most readily accepted and the fusion of socialism and nationalism completed. In the later 20s, and until the advent to power of Hitler, a circle of young men gathered round the journal Die Tat and, led by Ferdinand Fried, became the chief exponent of this tradition in the intellectual sphere. Fried's Ende des Kapitalismus is perhaps the most characteristic product of this group of Edelnazis, as they were known in Germany, and is particularly disquieting because of its resemblance to so much of the literature which we see in England and the United States today, where we can watch the same drawing together of the socialists of the left and the right, and nearly the same contempt of all that is liberal in the old sense. Conservative socialism, and, in other circles, religious socialism, was the slogan under which a large number of writers prepared the atmosphere in which national socialism succeeded. It is conservative socialism which is the dominant trend among us now. Had the war against the Western powers, with the weapons of the spirit and of economic organization, not almost succeeded before the real war began? Chapter 13. The Totalitarians in Our Midst. When authority presents itself in the guise of organization, it develops charms fascinating enough to convert communities of free people into totalitarian states. The Times, London. Probably it is true that the very magnitude of the outrages committed by the totalitarian governments, instead of increasing the fear that such a system might one day arise in more enlightened countries, has rather strengthened the assurance that it cannot happen here. When we look to Nazi Germany, The gulf which separates us seems so immense that nothing that happens there can possess relevance for any possible development here. And the fact that the difference has steadily become greater seems to refute any suggestion that we may be moving in a similar direction. But let us not forget that 15 years ago the possibility of such a thing happening in Germany would have appeared just as fantastic, not only to 9/10 of the Germans themselves, but also to the most hostile foreign observers, however wise they may now pretend to have been. As suggested earlier in these pages, however, it is not the present Germany, but the Germany of 20 or 30 years ago, to which conditions in the democracies show an ever-increasing resemblance. There are many features which were then regarded as typically German, and which are now equally familiar in England, for instance, and many symptoms that point to a further development in the same direction. We have already mentioned the most significant, the increasing similarity between the economic views of the right and left, and their common opposition to the liberalism that used to be the common basis of most English politics. We have the authority of Mr. Harold Nicholson for the statement that, during the last conservative government, among the backbenchers of the conservative party, the most gifted were all socialists at heart. Spectator, April 12, 1940, page 523. And there can be little question that, as in the days of the Fabians, many socialists have more sympathy with the conservatives than with the liberals. There are many other features closely related to this. The increasing veneration for the state, the admiration of power, and of bigness for bigness's sake, the enthusiasm for organization of everything, we now call it planning, and that inability to leave anything to the simple power of organic growth, which even von Treitschke deplored in the Germans 60 years ago, are all scarcely less marked in England now than they were in Germany. How far in the last 20 years England has traveled on the German path is brought home to one with extraordinary vividness if one now reads some of the more serious discussions of the differences between British and German views on political and moral issues, which appeared in England during the last war. It is probably true to say that then the British public had, in general, a truer appreciation of these differences than it has now. But while the people of England were then proud of their distinctive tradition, there are few of the political views, then regarded as characteristically English, of which the majority of her people do not now seem half ashamed, if they do not positively repudiate them. It is scarcely an exaggeration to say that the more typically English a writer on political or social problems then appeared to the world, the more is he today forgotten in his own country. Men like Lord Morley or Henry Sidgwick, Lord Acton or A.V. Dicey, who were then admired in the world at large as outstanding examples of the political wisdom of liberal England, are to the present generation largely obsolete Victorians. Perhaps nothing shows this change more clearly than that, while there is no lack of sympathetic treatment of Bismarck in contemporary English literature, the name of Gladstone is rarely mentioned by the younger generation without a sneer over his Victorian morality and naive utopianism. I wish I could, in a few paragraphs, adequately convey the alarming impression gained from the perusal of a few of the English works on the ideas dominating the Germany of the last war, where almost every word could be applied to the views most conspicuous in current English literature. I shall merely quote one brief passage by Lord Keynes, describing in 1915 the nightmare which he found expounded in a typical German work of that period. He describes how, according to a German author, even in peace, industrial life must remain mobilized. This is what he means by speaking of the militarization of our industrial life, the title of the work reviewed. Individualism must come to an end absolutely. A system of regulations must be set up, the object of which is not the greater happiness of the individual. Professor Haffe is not ashamed to say this in so many words, but the strengthening of the organized unity of the state for the object of attaining the maximum degree of efficiency, Leistungsfähigkeit, the influence of which on individual advantage is only indirect. This hideous doctrine is enshrined in a sort of idealism. The nation will grow into a closed unity and will become, in fact, what Plato declared it should be, der Mensch im Großen. In particular, the coming peace will bring with it a strengthening of the idea of state action in industry, Foreign investment, emigration, the industrial policy, which in recent years had regarded the whole world as a market, are too dangerous. The old order of industry, which is dying today, is based on profit. And the new Germany of the 20th century, power without consideration of profit, is to make an end of that system of capitalism, which came over from England 100 years ago. Economic Journal, 1915, page 450. Except that no English author has yet, to my knowledge, dared openly to disparage individual happiness, is there a passage in this which is not mirrored in much of contemporary English literature? And undoubtedly, not merely the ideas which in Germany and elsewhere prepared totalitarianism, but also many of the principles of totalitarianism itself are what exercises an increasing fascination in many other countries. Although few people, if anybody, in England would probably be ready to swallow totalitarianism whole, there are few single features which have not yet been advised by somebody or other. Indeed, there is scarcely a leaf out of Hitler's book which somebody or other in England or America has not recommended us to take and use for our own purposes. This applies particularly to many people who are undoubtedly Hitler's mortal enemies because of one special feature of his system. We should never forget that the anti-Semitism of Hitler, as driven from his country or turned into his enemies, many people who in every respect are confirmed totalitarians of the German type. Especially when we consider the proportion of former socialists who have become Nazis, it is important to remember that the true significance of this ratio is seen only if we compare it, not with the total number of former socialists, but with the number of those whose conversion would not in any case have been prevented by their ancestry. In fact, one of the surprising features of the political emigration from Germany is the comparatively small number of refugees from the left who are not Jews in the German sense of the term. How often do we not hear eulogies of the German system, prefaced by some statement such as the following, with which, at a recent conference, an enumeration of the features of the totalitarian technique of economic mobilization, which are worth thinking about, was introduced. Herr Hitler is not my ideal, far from it. There are very pressing personal reasons why Herr Hitler should not be my ideal. But no description in general terms can give an adequate idea of the similarity of much of current English political literature to the works which destroyed the belief in Western civilization in Germany and created the state of mind in which Nazism could become successful. The similarity is even more one of the temper with which the problems are approached than of the specific arguments used. A similar readiness to break all cultural ties with the past and to stake everything on the success of a particular experiment. As was also true in Germany, most of the works which are preparing the way for a totalitarian course in the democracies are the product of sincere idealists, and often of men of considerable intellectual distinction. So, although it is invidious to single out particular persons as illustrations where similar views are advocated by hundreds of others, I see no other way of demonstrating effectively how far this development has actually advanced. I shall deliberately choose as illustrations authors whose sincerity and disinterestedness are above suspicion. But though I hope in this way to show how the views from which totalitarianism springs are now rapidly spreading here, I stand little chance of conveying successfully the equally important similarity in the emotional atmosphere. An extensive investigation into all the subtle changes in thought and language would be necessary to make explicit what one readily enough recognizes as symptoms of a familiar development. Through meeting the kind of people who talk about the necessity of opposing big ideas to small ones and of replacing the old static or partial thinking by the new dynamic or global way, one learns to recognize that what at first appears sheer nonsense is a sign of the same intellectual attitude with whose manifestations we can alone concern ourselves here. My first examples are two works by a gifted scholar which, in the past few years, have attracted much attention. There are perhaps few other instances in contemporary English literature where the influence of the specific German ideas with which we are concerned is so marked as in Professor E. H. Carr's books on the 20 Years Crisis and the Conditions of Peace. In the first of these two books, Professor Carr frankly confessed himself an adherent of the historical school of realists, which had its home in Germany, and whose development can be traced through the great names of Hegel and Marx. A realist, he explains, is one who makes morality a function of politics, and who cannot logically accept any standard of value save that of fact. This realism is contrasted, in truly German fashion, with the utopian thought dating from the 18th century, which was essentially individualist in that it made the human conscience the final court of appeal. But the old morals, with their abstract general principles, must disappear because the empiricist treats the concrete case on its individual merits. In other words, nothing but expediency matters. And we are even assured that the rule pacta sunt servanda is not a moral principle, that without abstract general principles, merit becomes solely a matter of arbitrary opinion, and that international treaties, if they are not morally binding, have no meaning whatever, does not seem to worry Professor Carr. According to Professor Carr, indeed, although he does not explicitly say so, it appears that England fought the last war on the wrong side. Anyone who rereads now the statements of British war aims of 25 years ago and compares them with Professor Carr's present views will readily see that what were then believed to be the German views are now those of Professor Carr, who would presumably argue that the different views then professed in this country were merely a product of British hypocrisy. How little difference he is able to see between the ideals held in this country and those practiced by present-day Germany is best illustrated by his assertion that it is true that when a prominent National Socialist asserts that anything that benefits the German people is right, anything that harms them is wrong, he is merely propounding the same identification of national interest with universal right which has already been established for English-speaking countries by President Wilson, Professor Toynbee, Lord Cecil, and many others. Since Professor Carr's books are devoted to international problems, it is mainly in that field that their characteristic tendency becomes apparent. But from the glimpses one gets of the character of the future society which he contemplates, it appears also to be quite on the totalitarian model. Sometimes one even wonders whether the resemblance is accidental or deliberate. Does Professor Carr, for example, realize when he asserts that we can no longer find much meaning in the distinction familiar to the 19th century thought between society and state, that this is precisely the doctrine of Professor Carl Schmitt, the leading Nazi theoretician of totalitarianism, and, in fact, the essence of the definition of totalitarianism which that author has given to that term which he himself had introduced? Or that the view that the mass production of opinion is the corollary of the mass production of goods, and that, therefore, the prejudice which the word propaganda still exerts in many minds today is closely parallel to the prejudice against control of industry and trade, is really an apology for a regimentation of opinion of the kind practiced by the Nazis. In his more recent Conditions of Peace, Professor Carr answers with an emphatic affirmative the question with which we concluded the last chapter. The victors lost the peace, and Soviet Russia and Germany won it, because the former continued to preach, and in part to apply, the once valid but now disruptive ideals of the rights of nations and laissez-faire capitalism, whereas the latter, consciously or unconsciously borne forward on the tide of the 20th century, were striving to build up the world in larger units under centralized planning and control. Professor Carr completely makes his own the German battle cry of the socialist revolution of the East against the liberal West, in which Germany was the leader. The revolution which began in the last war, which has been the driving force of every significant political movement in the last 20 years, a revolution against the predominant ideas of the 19th century, liberal democracy, national self-determination, and laissez-faire economics. As he himself rightly says, it was almost inevitable that this challenge to 19th century beliefs, which she had never really shared, should find in Germany one of its strongest protagonists. With all the fatalistic belief of every pseudo-historian since Hegel and Marx, this development is represented as inevitable. We know the direction in which the world is moving, and we must bow to it or perish. The conviction that this trend is inevitable is characteristically based on familiar economic fallacies, the presumed necessity of the general growth of monopolies in consequence of technological developments, the alleged potential plenty, and all the other popular catchwords which appear in works of this kind. Professor Carr is not an economist, and his economic argument generally will not bear serious examination. But neither this nor his belief characteristically held at the same time, that the importance of the economic factor in social life is rapidly decreasing, prevents him from basing on economic arguments all his predictions about the inevitable developments, or from presenting as his main demands for the future the reinterpretation in predominantly economic terms of the democratic ideals of equality and liberty. Professor Carr's contempt for all the ideas of liberal economists, which he insists on calling 19th century ideas, though he knows that Germany had never really shared them and had already, in the 19th century, practiced most of the principles he now advocates, is as profound as that of any of the German writers quoted in the last chapter. He even takes over the German thesis, originated by Friedrich List, that free trade was a policy dictated solely by, and appropriate only to, the special interests of England in the 19th century. Now, however, the artificial production of some degree of autarky is a necessary condition of orderly social existence. To bring about a return to a more dispersed and generalized world trade by a removal of trade barriers or by a resuscitation of the laissez-faire principles of the 19th century is unthinkable. The future belongs to Großraumwirtschaft of the German kind. The result which we desire can be won only by a deliberate reorganization of European life such as Hitler has undertaken. After all this, one is hardly surprised to find a characteristic section headed The Moral Functions of War, in which Professor Carr condescendingly pities the well-meaning people, especially in English-speaking countries, who, steeped in the 19th century tradition, persist in regarding war as senseless and devoid of purpose, and rejoices in the sense of meaning and purpose which war, the most powerful instrument of social solidarity, creates. This is all very familiar, but it was not in the works of English scholars that one expected to find these views. Possibly we have not yet given enough attention to one feature of the intellectual development in Germany during the last 100 years, which is now in an almost identical form, making its appearance in the English-speaking countries, the scientists agitating for a scientific organization of society. The ideal of a society organized through and through, from the top, has in Germany been considerably furthered by the quite unique influence which her scientific and technological specialists were allowed to exercise on the formation of social and political opinions. Few people remember that, in the modern history of Germany, the political professors have played a role comparable to that of the political lawyers in France. Compare Franz Schneiber, Deutsche Geschichte im 19. Jahrhundert 2, 1933, page 204. The influence of these scientist politicians was, of late years, not often on the side of liberty, the intolerance of reason so frequently conspicuous in the scientific specialist, the impatience with the ways of the ordinary man so characteristic of the expert, and the contempt for anything which was not consciously organized by superior minds according to a scientific blueprint, were phenomena familiar in German public life for generations before they became of significance in England. And perhaps no other country provides a better illustration of the effects on a nation of a general and thorough shift of the greater part of its educational system from the humanities to the realities than Germany between 1840 and 1940. I believe it was the author of Leviathan who first suggested that the teaching of the classics should be suppressed because it instilled a dangerous spirit of liberty. the way in which, in the end, with few exceptions, her scholars and scientists put themselves readily at the service of the new rulers, is one of the most depressing and shameful spectacles in the whole history of the rise of National Socialism. The servility of the scientists to the powers that be appeared early in Germany, hand in hand with the great development of state-organized science, which today is the subject of